Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of July 2nd, or should I say July 4th, 2010. Coming up on the show, we'll hear a dirty little secret from the world of microfinance.
Countries like Mexico and Nigeria, where the demand is really high and the amount of money available is lower, people can charge pretty much whatever they want.
Microloans are not always what they seem. And here's the last thing a small business owner in Arizona wants to hear.
When I'm driving, I'm not comfortable. I don't want to go anywhere, so I stop the shopping.
Immigrants are withdrawing themselves and their dollars because of a new law. But first, happy birthday, America! Now, Uncle Sam, I know you could use a little spending money these days, what with that $13 trillion national debt and all. But instead of a cash card, we're going to treat everyone to a barbecue. Specifically, how to take top honors for best party without running up a $13 trillion bill. For some advice, we turn to the gentleman of the dinner party download, Brendan Francis Noonan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tess. Thanks for having me.
Happy holidays.
Thanks for calling me a gentleman.
Well,
I wouldn't.
You know, borderline. Enrico Galliano.
Hey, also
Rico.
A gentleman. Hello.
Well, yeah. You know.
Gentle.
An officer and a gentleman.
Happy 4th to both of you.
Likewise. So we thought about it, Tess, and we think we've come up with the secret for winning the 4th of July cookout, which is pretty simple.
I hope so, because I'm throwing one.
Well, here you go. Avoid the middle ground. You either want to go large and expensive or very small and cheap, because okay. That's what this holiday is all about.
Yeah, right? This holiday is about America, so it's about working hard and coming home and apple pie and going to church on Sundays.
Humble.
But America is also about Humvees and spectacular firework explosions.
Of course.
And so this, you need to either go acoustic or go to 11.
So where are we going to start on this?
Well, we thought about the important parts of the cookout, and we've got suggestions for going either direction with either of them. And
Okay. We're
going to start with the most important part, which is beer.
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 And the end.
Yeah,
bring
exactly.
It.
Barbecue over. You won.
Whoever brings the most gets an extra burger.
God
to the victor
bless America.
Goes the spoils. Here, no, but we're going to start with the spectacular option for beer. At your cookout, you could trot out a single bottle of a beer called Tactical Nuclear Penguin. This beer... This beer has the highest alcohol content of any brew on Earth. It is 32% alcohol, which is 6 times more potent than Budweiser.
Where's this from?
It's from Scotland, actually. So you also get to celebrate the fact that, you know, we're now friends with our former overlords.
But tell them how much it costs.
It is it's £35 sterling for a 330 milliliter bottle.
Don't make me do the math on
that. That's like $50.
It's over $50.
Yeah.
But it's 32% alcohol, so everyone only needs to drink a thimbleful.
So that's in the tradition of spectacular, but thimblefuls of beer is not what 4th of July is about. So I suggest you buy cheap American beer. Nothing more than $1 a can, something that comes in 24, 18 packs. Good rule of thumb is if the beer can looks like an American flag. So Pabst Blue Ribbon, Budweiser, these are great American beers. You can buy gobs of them. You fill up a cooler. And what is more bountiful and beautiful than a cooler overflowing with ice-cold American flag beer?
All right. So you've got the beer covered.
Okay.
Very
right.
Well. Next important thing is charcoal. Here is if you want to go large and spectacular. You can go with the Binsho charcoal. This is made in Japan by artisans. It takes like a week to make a batch of this stuff. It is famous for having no filler or impurities, and it is also stupidly hard to find. And when you do find it, it will cost at least $12 a pound, which is probably more than the meat that you're actually cleaning.
$12 a pound?
That
but it's like
correct.
Pure charcoal. This is like cooking your steaks on Brita filters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like perfect. Which leads us to the cheaper option, liquid smoke.
Sure.
So liquid smoke, you can buy at any grocery store. It's like $3 for 4 ounces.
Right,
and you
yep.
just put a couple drops of that on anything, and it tastes perfectly barbecued.
Even nice. On your watermelon?
You could make your watermelon barbecue.
That actually doesn't sound bad to me.
Exactly.
Maybe is a bad reflection
exactly.
on me.
Now, some people look down their nose at liquid smoke, but it is one of the secret ingredients in curing bacon.
And there's nothing more American than bacon.
Yeah, come on.
All right. Well, I think... Maybe I'll think about the liquid smoke, but I'm definitely not putting that in my homemade ketchup.
Homemade ketchup?
I'm doing homemade ketchup and homemade ice cream.
See, now that actually, you could say that is spectacular because it certainly takes a lot of time and effort to make.
Heirloom tomatoes from the farmer's market.
And I'm guessing heirloom tomatoes cost more than buying a bottle of Heinz at the supermarket.
I think
as well.
They cost more than the beer that you were making.
They probably cost more than the clothes that I'm wearing.
I know that costs more than your clothes, actually.
All right. Well, before we have another Revolutionary War right here in the studio,
that's right.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Happy 4th.
Happy 4th.
Happy 4th, Tess. But do you know what would be a happier 4th?
Oh.
You know, if you could invite us over. We really have no plans for the July.
That's right.
We talk a big game here, but...
I don't think I have enough croquet balls.
I'll bring the ketchup.
Everywhere around the world. You can find much more of The Funny from Brendan and Rico on iTunes or dinnerpartydownload.com. Every time that flag's unfurled. All right. Well, you know, it used to be that there was nothing more American than a pension to ensure a well-financed retirement. Most workers today have 401k plans. Government employees are an exception. But the guarantees they thought they had are going the way of the pensions themselves, because budget woes are forcing deep cuts in those promised benefits. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I don't have a pension, so I asked Ron Snell at the National Council of State Legislatures to give me the lowdown.
You stay in the job 30 years, you have a guaranteed lifetime pension.
Here's how it works. Employer and employee contribute every month to a pension fund. It then invests the money and pays out a certain amount to each worker after they retire. Problem is, the funds that pay the pensions aren't so secure, at least in the long term. I point out to Snell a report from the Pew Center on the States. It found state pensions were underfunded by $1 trillion, and that was before the financial crisis.
It's a very large problem. A surprising number of states have started dealing with the issue in legislation this year.
In Wyoming, California, Iowa, and Vermont, workers will now pay more into their pension plans. In New Jersey, retirement benefits will be cut. Workers have sued. In Minnesota, New Mexico, and Colorado, retirees' cost of living increases are being trimmed. Retirees have sued. Brenda Scott of the Mississippi Alliance of State Employees told me about the changes there. As of July 1st, Mississippi will take about 2% more out of every worker's paycheck, and new employees will have to work an extra 5 years to get a full pension.
So we thought that that would be a pretty bitter pill to swallow, considering the fact that we were going into the third year without any kind of pay increase.
Scott says her union fought back, but lost. Ernest Simpson is philosophical about it. He's a supervisor in the state child support office in Gulfport, Mississippi. He's 5 years from getting his pension, for which he'll now pay a bit more.
I figured it up. It's about $50-$55 a month. You know, with the economy is now, anytime you take money away from your pay, it's going to hurt you. But if it's going to help us continue to have our retirement system financially sound, then I don't mind suffering.
Many public employee unions are giving in grudgingly as well. They've realized they've got a choice between cutting pension benefits or losing jobs. Some states, meanwhile, are looking at a more radical solution. They're moving away from pensions altogether.
There's one thing that can bankrupt the state of Utah, and that is our pension system.
Dan Lilienquist is a state senator. He's behind Utah's decision to put new government workers into a defined contribution plan, like a 401k. That means the state will pay its retirement bill right up front.
Instead of saying, here's what we want to give to our new employees, and then hoping we can pay for it later, we said, here's how much we can afford to give, and what does it buy?
Lilienquist says other states' reforms trim pension costs a little, but they still leave governments on the hook if markets tank. For him, the beauty of the Utah plan is that it transfers market risk to plan participants and shields Utah's treasury from the fallout of the next financial crisis. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace Money.
Microfinancing has become pretty trendy over the last few years. Thousands of ordinary people have given small loans to farmers in Namibia or corner store owners in Kazakhstan. You give to Kiva.org or Microplace.com. They find a lender in-country to dole out the money. But it turns out your charitable gift could be headed straight into the pocket of the lender. Neil McFarquhar wrote about this recently in the New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, you know, it seems like microfinance got out of the gate really quickly, got a lot of attention, a Nobel Prize a few years ago for its creator, and I guess maybe it just takes time to see some of the rough edges of something like this?
I think that it started out as a do-good project, but gradually over the years, especially in the past decade, as it became clear that, you know, you could make a profit at it, that anybody who lends money to the poor slaps the name microfinance on it. And I think that's what's giving some of its founders pause.
Well, what are some of the problems that have emerged as the appeal of this kind of lending has grown?
Basically, it's just that there isn't really a standard of where to set interest rates and profits. And so some companies, particularly in countries like Mexico and Nigeria, where the demand is really high and the amount of money available is lower, people can charge pretty much whatever they want. And so you see high interest rates and high profits.
And talk to us about how this is happening. You know, here on the show, we have profiled organizations like Kiva.org. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the issues are not necessarily with those organizations, but with the folks who are doing this at the local level, on the ground level.
Organizations like Kiva, they don't always do due diligence about where that money is going and what interest rates the organization is charging. And I found one called Lapo in Nigeria, and Kiva had an outdated interest rate of 57%, whereas the real interest rate was above 80%. So that's what the debate is around in the microfinance community. It's like, how do you set a fair standard for reasonable interest rates and reasonable profits and still carry the name microfinance?
Yeah, even at 57%, that sounds like an enormous interest rate.
It costs a lot of money to lend to poor people in rural or urban areas that can be inaccessible. And, you know, it varies from country to country, because in Bangladesh, you don't have to pay a loan officer that much, whereas in Mexico, you do, because it's a middle-class society. The idea is to try and find some formula that allows microfinance institutions to make a reasonable profit so that they're sustainable and they can continue working, but not that they're making, you know, 25, 30 or higher percentage point profits on the backs of the poor.
So is it possible to say exactly who's cashing in on the back end? You know, if something shady is going on, is that happening at the local level, or is it happening at some of these name organizations that we know?
There are thousands of microfinance institutions around the world, and it's a $60 billion industry, as it were. So it's hard to quantify, because there is no sort of super organization policing it. But there are a couple organizations that are trying to sort of set standards. One's called the Mixed Market, and they ask microfinance institutions to report their own numbers, and they put them up on the website for everyone to see. But, you know, there again, they rely on the organization's own numbers. So you kind of need an independent auditor to go in behind them to see if they're being honest.
Neil McFarquhar is the United Nations Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and we've been talking about some issues with microlending. Thanks so much for your time.
Anytime.
You know, that idea of someone rolling in money? Turns out taking it literally might be a good idea.
When people are reminded of money and they feel that they have some money, this means that they don't need to be liked by others. They don't need to be included by other people because they have money to take care of their wants and needs.
Touch it, touch it, touch the money. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out once again this week is Liz Pulliam-Weston of MSN Money. Happy 4th to you.
Thanks, Tess. You too.
So I have a couple of questions for you since I have you here in the studio. First of all, of course, everybody talking about the new financial reform bill. You've seen it. What are your thoughts on it? Good, bad, indifferent?
You know what? Far more than we expected at
really?
One point. Yeah, we thought this effort was just going to run into a wall. And fortunately, enough attention was focused on it that there are some good things in that bill. One of the things that I like is the Consumer Protection Agency.
Right.
That was very, very controversial. It looked like it was going to be thrown overboard at one point. Now it looks like, or it's going to be, inside the Fed. And what
and it will be a bureau, not an agency.
It will be a bureau, not an agency. but as Barney Frank put it, you know, it will be housed at the Fed. They won't even be allowed to open its mail. So hopefully
nice.
We will have a very independent and far-reaching agency that can look over a lot of the things that affect consumers and make sure that they're not getting burned.
Anything you were hoping to see in there that isn't in there?
Oh, there's a bunch of things. There's a bunch of things. One of the things I would have loved to have seen is a fiduciary standard applied to all people who are putting themselves out as financial advisors.
And by fiduciary standard, you mean that you have to put the client's interests ahead of your own.
Exactly. And a lot of people think that's the way it is now, and unfortunately it's not. What the fiduciary standard does is say, you know what? This person, your client, comes first. And even if it means you pocket less, you have to put the client first and make sure that what you're recommending is the best fit for them.
All right, Liz, I suppose we should take some calls. That's what we're here for.
That sounds like a good idea to me.
All right. Well, Jackie is on the line in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Jackie.
Hello.
Where do you hear the show?
KNOW in St. Paul.
All right. Well, you have an interesting job. You're a writer, and in the past, you've also helped people write their memoirs.
Yes.
What kinds of people? Is this friends or is this people that we would know?
Well, the one person that has her memoir out now is Eileen Fritsch, who was the woman who went skydiving at age 90. She was a nurse up until age 80.
Wow.
Kind of a good example for a lot of people on how to deal with life and what the challenges life throws our way.
Now, you actually got caught up in Eileen's finances at one point. What happened?
Well, when she did her skydive, her grandson, who had become alienated from the family, saw her on TV and contacted his grandmother, came up to visit. And then the next year, of course, 2005, Katrina struck. He called his grandmother and asked if he could come up and live with her because he didn't have any place to live. And she said, fine. And when he got back to her, he said, well, I'm coming up and I'm bringing four friends who also were made completely homeless from Katrina.
Hmm.
And so everybody in the neighborhood got together, all her friends, and fixed up her house to have five house guests. And that was great. You know, we all enjoyed meeting the people from New Orleans. Well, they eventually moved out through the help of FEMA, but one of the guys wanted to go to school, and he didn't have anybody to sign for him. So I co-signed his student loan.
Uh-oh. I know where this is going.
Yes, you can guess it.
So has he not paid off his loans and now you're on the hook?
Yes. Well, I've had this friendly relationship with Sallie Mae since the loan came due. I realized that it wasn't going to be paid off. I understood that I could pay it off for a while and then my name would be taken off. But it turns out to be very confusing and that's apparently not the case. And I don't know what to do now.
Liz, is there anything that's not confusing about student loans?
Oh,
any
man.
Which way you talk about them?
Here's the deal with getting your name off a co-signed private student loan. Typically, the student is the one who has to make the payments for, say, a period of 2 years before the co-signer's name can be taken off.
Hmm.
So it sounds like, unfortunately, you got information that, you know, you could be relieved of responsibility for this loan, but that's only the case if the other borrower is picking up his responsibility, which he's not doing.
Have you talked with him about this?
Cannot find this person.
Oh, geez. Any options here, Liz?
You know, they're all bad. Unfortunately, you cannot get rid of student loans typically in bankruptcy. So she can not pay the loans and continue to suffer the damage to her credit scores. But the fact is that these collectors can come after you for life. So how much money are we talking about here?
Well, the loan originally was for $11,000, but now, of course, there's interest on it, so that's mounting to about $14,000.
Okay. Have you talked to Sallie Mae at all about settling for less than the total amount?
They didn't seem to be interested in negotiating.
Yeah, well, because they have all the cards. You know,
right.
They can pursue you till the end of your life for this debt. So
Can't you ask them to pursue him?
You can, but, I mean, they know you've got the money. You know, you are the one who co-signed. They know you're responsible. They know they can find you. They've got you. So, yeah, at this point, if it's a case where you can possibly, you know, negotiate with these folks and get that total down, that's the way to go. Otherwise, really, the only answer is to just start paying it.
Jackie, you really came to know a lot of people in this family. Is there anyone else that you can go to get some help here?
Well, I think for this particular ex-student, no. I took it on as my responsibility. And,
yeah.
You know, I think anybody would do it to help somebody out. I would like to reach a settlement. I don't mind paying some, but I think to have to pay the whole thing off the rest of my life is not exactly a good idea.
That wasn't in your retirement plan,
no,
I take it.
No.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you know, that old saying about no good deed goes unpunished comes to mind. Yeah. But this is the case with co-signing a loan. You are equally responsible for it. I wish I had better news for you, but you're kind of up against a wall with this one. The law is all in their favor, and very little of it is in your favor.
Well, if I were to default on paying it, then what does that mean for my credit rating?
It would trash your credit rating.
Completely, or?
Well, as long as the debt isn't being paid, yeah, it's going to be continuing to inflict damage on your credit report. And the more months that pass without a payment, the worse the damage is going to be. And then it will go to collections. That'll wind up as a collections on your credit report. That's bad.
You do not want that.
Yeah. It's the sort of situation where they can go to court and get a judgment against you, and then that's on your record as well. They could garnish your wages. I mean, there's a world of hurt that's involved in defaulting on a student loan. I might go to an experienced bankruptcy attorney, not to file bankruptcy, but because they will know the laws of your state. They will see your situation, look at your total finances, and see how vulnerable you are, and may be able to help you with the negotiations.
Well, that at least puts some light at the end of the tunnel there.
Yeah, better than nothing anyway.
Jackie, if you had to do it all over again, would you do it?
I think I would think about it a little harder.
Yeah,
that's wise.
All right. Well, hey, let us know what you end up doing and how it goes.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much. I really learned a lot.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
And next up, we've got Estelle, and she's in Baltimore. Hi, Estelle.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. And where do you catch us there in Baltimore?
WYPR.
WYPR in beautiful Baltimore.
Thank you.
So you and your husband are quite the good planners when it comes to finance, right?
Yes, we have planned since we got married that we would, you know, take care of the children. The children came first. And our philosophy is that we pay for their schooling, undergrad and postgrad, whatever that would be, have them to be debt-free, and then they can go out in the world, and then they're prepared to take care of themselves.
I hope they have sent you really, really large thank you notes.
They're really good children, and they do understand now what that means to be debt-free.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be one of the biggest, most massive gifts that parents could ever give to their children. Yeah,
and it's a tough one. You know, it takes a lot of sacrifice and a lot of hard work.
Do you have retirement funds, or did you put those off?
Well, no, we do have those as well. We were very lucky. We just planned very well, and we don't have a very expensive lifestyle. You know, we live within our means and just do the best that we can, and we've just been very fortunate.
Wow. So have the kids then turned out to be good with their money?
There's two philosophies. There's ours, where we do everything for the kids, and, you know, we don't have them take jobs. Your job is to go to school. Well, the other side is, well, you know, to teach you fiscal responsibility, you have to get a job, and you have to go out and pay for part of your schooling or all of your schooling. And interestingly enough, I find that my children are much more careful and responsible with their money than the other side.
Hmm.
So far, I think at least for our children and our family, they do understand the value of the dollar, and they're very careful. They always buy things on sale. They're so proud to say, "Mommy, I got this on sale. You'd be very proud of me."
We do like to brag about buying things on sale, don't we?
Oh, yes, we do.
Being responsible, that's awesome. That's great.
Well, it doesn't sound like you need us.
Well, here's my issue. So the third child is coming along the pike. And he has a very lovely girlfriend, and they are considering getting married. But the philosophy is the other side, and there will be some debt, and I think some considerable debt on the other side.
Oh, on the girlfriend's side.
Yeah. So I don't know how to manage that or get a handle around that. What happens when the one marries the other? Like for my son, what will that mean for him? What does that do to his credit rating?
Well, let me ask you this first of all. How old is he?
22.
He's 22. Liz, are we beyond the point where mom needs to be worrying about this?
Well, maybe theoretically.
Moms never stop worrying.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, there's a whether they will stop worrying or whether they should.
Yeah. I think at this point, obviously, you're going to be in the role of advisor when asked kind of a
Correct.
Thing.
Correct.
So, yeah, I thought you were sensible enough to understand that.
Oh, come on. Jewish mothers are not sensible.
Here's what you need to know. This is very, very common, for one thing, for one person to have their financial act together and the other one to so not.
Yep.
And the good news is that there's no such thing as a combined credit score or a combined credit report. They will continue to have their own separate credit reports and scores.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But the reality is that when they go for their first mortgage together, they probably will go together, and it will be determined what the rate they get will be determined by the lower set of credit scores.
Okay.
So if she's got ongoing unresolved problems with debt, you know, she's defaulting or there's, you know, that kind of problem, they either won't be able to get a mortgage or they'll pay a lot more for it. The other reality is that the money that's going to go to pay off the debt she's already accumulated will come from both their pockets. You know, you can say it's going to be separate, but once you're a married unit, as you know,
right,
whatever decisions are made are going to affect both of you. I always recommend the least romantic date idea in the world, which is to sit down in front of your computer together and and get your annual credit reports from annualcreditreport.com.
Liz, you are so much fun.
Oh, I know. I just know how to, you know, light the room on fire so that they can see exactly what they're getting into. And I know so many people who had wished they had done that before they got married.
But do they wish that mom had done it for them?
No. No one in the world
would
wish that.
Although she'd be so happy to. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. So are you going to sit them down, or are you going to let them come to you on this?
No, he actually has come to me. He has come to us, I should say. He has. That's why I'm asking the question. And I was given permission to ask the question.
Excellent.
So
yay,
I'm
Mom.
Not doing right. this, you know, behind anyone's back. I made full disclosure.
Well, next time we'd love to talk to him. So tell him to give us a call.
Yeah, oh, her
no
too.
Problem.
And her. Yeah, we'd love to talk to both of them.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much, Estelle. Great question.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Next up, we have Rob in Boston. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Tess.
How do you usually hear us there in Boston?
On WBUR.
Boy, Independence Day in Boston. That is the place to be.
This is true. The fireworks down on the Hat Shell, it's crazy. Like something like a million people go into the city and watch those fireworks. So therefore, I get as far away from that part of town as I can.
You don't hang out on the Charles River with the masses?
Once you've done it once, you don't really need to do it again. Not to say that I don't enjoy it. I mean, I enjoy fireworks, but those fireworks, you know, once is enough.
So I know that you live in a very small, close-knit community there in Boston. You're in a condo.
That's right. I'm in a building with six units. We came together, the six-unit building, 5 years ago, and we've been really tight. You know, everyone's friends and gets along really well in the building. It's been a really a nice place to be for the past 5 years.
So how is it going in the condo complex then?
We're in sort of a transitional moment right now because for the first time, one of the folks who's been with us for the entire 5 years has decided to move on. And unfortunately, not under the circumstances he would have liked. He's decided to give up his condo through the route of a deed in lieu of foreclosure.
Oh, boy.
So,
this is going to be complicated.
Yeah, that's why I'm calling you guys. You know, he's essentially handing over the key to the place to the bank that sold him the mortgage, and they forgive the debts, they get the unit, and they get to sell it. So we're concerned a little bit about what happens next. Does the bank interact with us at all? Can we play any role in making sure they sell this place at the best possible price? I mean, everyone's already concerned about dropping prices on condominiums and other properties. So we want to do what we can to sort of best protect the interests of the condominium association, even though this sort of outside party is suddenly going to be part of our association for a short period of time.
Well, interesting question, Liz, because I think we have a lot of answers on foreclosures for single homes or even for apartments. But what about a condo association?
Good news is that a deed in lieu of foreclosure tends to be a little less messy than a regular foreclosure. It happens more quickly. And the bank should start taking over the homeowners association fees, the condo association fees. That's their responsibility as the new owner. What you have in the other situation with the foreclosure is typically the owner stops paying, so the condo association doesn't get its money for months or, again, years. Yeah. So that's the good news. The bad news is that there's not much you can do to tell the bank, sell this for the best possible price, because in your view, the best possible price is the highest price that keeps your properties up. In their view, they want to get rid of this property. They have a ton of other properties they're dealing with. They don't want to have to continue paying you the association fees. But again, there's a silver lining to that, which is you'll get another owner in there.
But how much is that potentially going to do then to the value of the other condos that are there? I mean, is it the same as a neighborhood?
My gut instinct is it's more of a factor
really?
Than it would be for a neighborhood. Because in most neighborhoods, there's a bunch of different construction, you know, different combination of bedrooms, bathrooms, whatever. Here you've got six units in the same building. They are, even if they're not cookie cutter, they're much more comparable than six houses on a block. So it is going to be a blow. But, you know, you guys bought pretty near the peak.
It was pretty much, it was about 6 months before the peak timed so perfectly, and then things started dropping.
Yeah. Well, it will affect the value of the remaining units. If you have any concerns, if you're not being paid the fees, then it's probably good to talk to, you have an attorney with your condo association?
We have ones that we've worked with from time to time, yes.
Okay. If that becomes a problem, then get in touch with the attorney and get those wheels in motion because, you know, the lender is supposed to keep up their end of it while they own it.
Okay.
So not a lot of easy answers.
Right. Well, that's kind of what I figured. You know, it's a tough time, so I just figured getting a little more information about it might help us at least to prepare for the inevitable anyway.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you, Tess.
Thanks so much. Appreciate the call.
You betcha. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, whether it is the housing collapse or collapse in your personal finances, do give us a call. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email your question. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz Pulliam-Weston of MSN Money, thanks so much and have a great 4th.
You too, Tess.
And remember to check with your own financial expert before making any big money decisions. Arizona is on the front lines in the debate over immigration. The state attracted intense controversy with its new law authorizing police to check the ID of anyone suspected of being in the country illegally. Small business owners across Arizona are already paying a price, especially the ones that have catered to Hispanic customers. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
El Guero Canelo is a popular restaurant with Hispanics in Tucson. But since Arizona passed its tough new immigration law, business is down.
20%, you know, and with 70 employees, it's big.
That's general manager Arturo Contreras. He says many clients are leaving town.
Some of them say they're going to Canada, and some of them say they're going to Texas.
Some of his employees are moving too. When they're hired, Contreras gives each employee a uniform. Some workers abandon the job and the state because they have a relative who is undocumented. They fear the new law could result in the family being split up.
And so they don't give the uniform back?
Nope.
So when a worker leaves, Contreras needs to find a replacement and shell out around $50 for a new uniform. The situation is even worse for some business owners in Phoenix. Josefina Saldana owns the Zacatecas Beauty Salon.
Right now it's empty, but before we make like 40 or 50 customers each day. But right now we have one customer a day or two customers.
Rent on the salon runs about $1,500 a month, plus utilities.
I can pay my rent, I can pay my bills and everything, and I need customers, I need money.
Her longtime clients have left town. She says even Hispanics with proper papers feel unwelcome in the state. What will she do?
Maybe want it closed, or I don't know.
Saldana is trying to sell her beauty salon. She's asking $20,000, but willing to negotiate. No one wants to buy, she says, not in this environment. Even though she's a U.S. citizen, Saldana may have to relocate to another state.
Citizen or not citizen, we have to leave because we don't have work, so we don't have nothing to do over here.
Next door, a national chain store called Gen X specializes in hip-hop fashion and accessories. Kay Kim is district manager. She says the retailer used to cater to Hispanics. Now she's searching for a new clientele.
We do have more African-American peoples there right now. That's why we need to bring some different size and different type of clothes and merchandise.
She's nervous because sales were down about $20,000 last month. Business is slow, she says, with one exception. She sold a lot of luggage lately.
Not only Mexican people.
She says immigrants from Africa and Asia are moving too, afraid they'll be targeted under the new law. Kay Kim also worries. She's here legally from South Korea.
Even I'm Asian, but when I'm driving, I'm not comfortable. I don't want to go anywhere, so I stopped the shopping.
She says many Koreans came to Arizona and opened businesses, but now they're having second thoughts.
We got a lot of people decide to go back to California right now, so a lot of places going to be closed.
Kim wouldn't mind being district manager someplace else.
If my company don't want to transfer me to other states, I might quit. I'm not sure. I'm joking.
Business owners face a similar dilemma. Do they wait and hope their Hispanic customers return, or do they transfer to another business model or another state? In Phoenix, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace Money.
No matter who you are or where you come from, reducing reliance on credit cards has become a priority for many families. But some communities are having a tougher time doing that than others. A study by the NAACP showed 79% of Latino households carry credit card debt, compared with 54% of white households. And when it comes to the interest on those cards, Latinos pay a much higher rate. From WAMU in Washington, D.C., Rebecca Shear reports.
Lee Sanchez is a 31-year-old software developer in Silver Spring, Maryland. A few years back, he and his wife, Fanny, sold their house for a profit of $112,000.
A good chunk of change, a good chunk of money.
The likes of which they'd never seen before. But the windfall from the house sale didn't last long.
Growing up with my family, there was never really discussion of putting your money away. There's a short-term mentality. You know, the money's in the bank account, let's go ahead and spend it.
And spend they did on improvements to their new home.
We just went crazy. I mean, floors were put in, carpet, painting, crown molding, furniture. You can hear the cha-chings as I'm talking.
Sanchez had three kids in school and no savings to fall back on. Then he found himself out of work for a month. Sanchez says they should have cut back, but instead they pulled out the plastic.
We charged up like 15 grand worth of things within that 1 month because of bills that we had. It was pretty hectic.
Lee Sanchez went from having more than 100 grand burning a hole in his pocket to being $15,000 in the hole, which is why he destroyed all his credit cards, except one.
I have one for an emergency, but the ones that really got me in trouble, you do the bending thing about 30 times, they get really hot, and you rip it in half and throw it away.
But Sanchez is having a heck of a time throwing away his outstanding balances. 2 years later, he still owes about $6,000.
And these interest rates in these cards, one I have is like 15, the other one's like 20%.
And that's not uncommon in the Latino community, according to Janice Bowdler, a wealth-building expert with National Council de la Raza.
We know that Latino families are more likely than whites with a similar profile to have interest rates over 20%.
Bowdler says many Hispanics she's spoken with are fed up by what they see as the tricks credit card companies play. She says Latinos often justify their spending by only using credit for so-called emergencies. But when you ask what they mean by that?
We found groceries and diapers were the emergencies families were using their credit cards for.
Not that using credit for everyday essentials is inherently wrong, or so says Curtis Arnold, founder of CardRatings.com.
The bad part about it is using credit for necessities and then not paying off your balance in full, not sticking to your budget, and suddenly you start paying 16, 17, 18% interest on groceries. And that's a recipe for disaster.
The problem, Arnold says, is what he calls a lack of financial literacy.
Credit education in the Latino community is lacking. Now, in general, all Americans are lacking, so I'm not picking on one community in particular.
But he says many credit card companies are. Arnold says they prey on minority communities like Latinos, targeting them with subprime cards marketed as starter credit.
These are high interest rate cards with low balances that can really set a family up to fail.
Again, Janice Bowdler.
So their first experience with credit can trap them into a cycle of really burdensome debt.
As Lee Sanchez struggles to get his head above water, he says he lives for the day he can get both of his credit card balances below $1,000.
You know, if I get below $1,000, I'll be doing cartwheels in the front yard.
In the meantime, he and his wife are keeping much closer tabs on their budget.
People think we're being cheap now, so, but we're not. We're just trying to change our ways, you know, change our ways.
By saving more, knowing when to use plastic and when to use cash, and teaching their children to do the same. In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm Rebecca Shear for Marketplace Money.
Not that you ask, but here's a little glimpse into my brain on money. So two things happen to me when I get cash out of an ATM. First, I experience this slight feeling of dread because I know by taking money out, my bank balance is going to shrink. But when those crisp bills pop out of the machine, I feel better. I really, really, really like having cash money, even if it's just a wad of ones. Well, I'm happy to report the studies prove I am not nuts. Kathleen Voss teaches marketing at the University of Minnesota, and she's been conducting some of those studies. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you take us through one of these experiences and tell us what you found?
Sure. In one of our experiments, our participants would come to the laboratory. They'd come alone, and their first task would be either counting out slips of paper as part of this finger dexterity task or counting out slips of money, hard currency. After that, and one other task to sort of clear the slate, we'd have the participants then go online, and they would engage in a virtual ball tossing game. The participant is not passed the ball by the other virtual players, and this elicits feelings of ostracism and social rejection. We exposed our participants to the game in which they were going to be socially ostracized. And later we asked them, how did you feel about that game? Did you feel valued by the other players? Did you feel rejected? Did you feel disrespected? And we found that after our participants had counted out money, as opposed to slips of paper, they felt less pain.
So literally just touching money made them feel better about themselves. So what does that tell you?
Well, it told us that money has pretty powerful psychological effects, and that the theory we were working off of is that when people are reminded of money and they feel that they have some money, this means that they don't need to be liked by others. They don't need to be included by other people because they have money to take care of their wants and needs.
But it's not like you were giving them money. They were just touching it.
Right, right, right. So the psychological symbolism of money is very deep. And even just mere reminders of money can elicit this construct and activate it in people's minds. And that seems to be enough to blunt the experience of pain.
The experiment that you talked about, you know, blunting this notion of pain, this was just on a computer. But there was one even more dramatic example where you had people then put their fingers in hot, scalding water. And the people who had touched money didn't feel as bad about that as the people who hadn't.
That is right. That's right. So we saw the same pattern of results. Instead of in the social pain domain, we moved it to the physical pain domain, and we see the same thing.
Well, so does that tell us that, you know, before surgery, we should have people roll around in a bunch of $20 bills?
I like the image. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the things, that's one of the implications. I've given several talks at medical conferences now because, sure, healthcare providers are very interested in the implications of this for how they can assuage pain in their patients.
But again, I guess I don't understand where the brain feels the value is, because again, you are not giving money. I mean, I can actually half understand how if people give you a bunch of money before you undergo a painful experience, that it might blunt that, but they're not actually giving you any money. You're not getting anything out of this.
That's right. That's right. So people's experience with money is common, it's frequent, and it occurs almost throughout the lifespan. I mean, people start experiencing events with money starting to be when they're 3 or 4 years old, at least in the U.S. And so you build up these associations over time. All of those experiences add up to this very thick layer that we can actually just elicit this construct by just merely showing them pictures of money or having them touch hard currency. That is enough to trip off this very well-oiled construct of what it means to have money.
I'm sure you haven't taken the research quite this far, but what would this mean in a barter society? I mean, is it the actual coin, the actual paper money that we're talking about here, or is it whatever it is that is getting you some sort of object that you want?
Yeah, it's more the latter. It is much more the latter. So, for example, if we move to a cashless society, then we should start to see credit cards take on some of these effects.
I don't know. I think those actually cause more pain than relieve it.
Right. Yes. No, Tess, you've got it exactly right. In my laboratory, when we use credit cards, it elicits all kinds of different effects. But yes, in a barter system, if you had a resource that was highly valued and everybody in your community knew that, then it would be that resource that tripped off these kinds of effects.
What do you think this all says about our connection with money and perhaps our obsession with it?
Well, in these experiments, one thing I'd like to point out is that when participants handle money, they don't feel like they have more self-esteem and they don't feel in a more positive mood. But the one thing that they do report that they feel is they say they feel strong. That's the item, strong. And I think that's gets at the heart of your question, is that our relationship with money is that money is this valued resource. In fact, you could argue that it might be the most valuable resource that people come in contact with. So I think this starts to illuminate that pathway, that when people are thinking about money or reminded of money, they get this feeling of strength. And as a consequence, they can be impervious to things that would otherwise be painful.
Well, I know we are not paying you for this interview, so I hope it wasn't too painful.
Oh, no, this is fun, so no need to pay.
Kathleen Voss is a professor of marketing at the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Management. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Our mission each week is to help as many of you get your finances in order as we can. So to end today's program, we thought we'd try to provide a little advice to someone in serious, serious hot water.
Hi, I'm Teresa Giudice from the Real Housewives of New Jersey.
Perhaps some of you, maybe even all of you, have been following her drama on the Bravo channel. Giudice and her husband have filed for bankruptcy. And it is not hard to figure out how they landed there.
You come to my house and it's like grand entrance. I love this piece. I had to have it. I couldn't live without it. Here's my Gucci glasses. Had to have these. My husband, Joe, is an entrepreneur, and he is very successful, and he lets me spend the money.
So, do you lock up the checkbooks in the safe? You know, every time Teresa comes, you got to lock them off.
So, exactly how much debt have they gotten themselves into? $11 million worth. But we thought Giudice could use our help, so we called up Gail Cunningham of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Hi, Gail.
Hey, Tess. How are you?
I'm good. But so first off, how is it possible to get into that much debt? What bank lets you do that?
Well, I would guess that their spending is spread across several credit cards, maybe even dozens. But goes without saying that they were living lavishly.
All right. Well, let's get to brass tacks. Where would you start with this Real Housewife?
Well, this Real Housewife just filed a real bankruptcy, and they have to receive financial counseling prior to filing. Now, what goes on during this session? The counselor will probe to see the root of the problem. What got these people into that situation? Now, I have to tell you, I wish I was a fly on the wall, because I bet that was a very interesting conversation.
So pretend that they would be coming into your office. What do you tell them?
Well, absolutely. We would talk to them about what they're going to do next. Obviously, they've made the decision to file bankruptcy, which I always hope is a person's last decision, not their first. But, you know, I think your listeners can identify with this. These people just happen to be in debt on steroids. They're going to have a very steep adjustment, as you might imagine. They've had a lot of fun. Americans are really good spenders, and these people max that out.
Gail Cunningham is with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and we thank you, and we're pretty sure, were she listening, that Teresa would thank you, too.
Thank you, Tess.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, since when is cheapskate a bad word?
They live happily below their means. So they're not just spending less than they make, which, of course, is not the American norm, sadly, these days. But, in fact, they're happier because of it.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Laura Dine-Million. Thanks this week to senior editor Patty Hirsch. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Happy 4th, everyone, and we'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, working to solve America's retirement savings challenge through innovation, service, and performance. Putnam, a world of investing.
American Public Media.